Please be sure to visit our Etsy store for some great Warrior Next Door podcast merchandise, and please consider becoming a premium subscriber. Just go to our Facebook page to sign up and receive each series uncut in its entirety.
Welcome back, Warrior Next Door listeners, for the second installment of the John Lucky Luckadoo series, a co-pilot for the 100th Bomb Group. And if you listened last week, you would have learned that John is a very direct person. He's going to let you know the unvarnished truth as he experienced it. So this week, we're going to dive into just more of the experiences that John has and some of the grievances as well that occurred during his time in the 100th Bomb Group. So enjoy. There's another thing that happened that you talk about in the book that I read about in another book. I read about in another book about how, you know, the 100th Bomb Group was kind of seen as a problem child in the Air Force early on. And they explained how the bomb group was supposed to muster to do this navigation flight, and a bunch of bombers just kind of flew off and did their own thing. And it ended up creating such a problem that the commander, I think Alkire, got demoted for it. And one of them was one of the pilots flew to his hometown to go visit his wife. And Lucky, that was your plane. I mean, what you know, Kevin, you write about it, but at what point did you realize that your pilot, Di, was going to go on a joyride and just land in a field somewhere to visit his wife?
No, that isn't correct, Tony. Oh. On that mission, that was a mock mission to San Francisco, to bomb San Francisco, and they hit a cloud deck and busted them up. And Alkire, the commander, landed in Las Vegas.
Oh, that's it.
And we went on and bombed San Francisco on that mission.
Okay.
But then on another occasion, we were on a practice mission, and then he never said a word to us about what he was going to do, but he veered off and landed in Steubenville, Ohio, which was his hometown. And this grass field was sogged in mud, and we stuck. We couldn't move the airplane, and so without telling the crew anything, he got all of the townspeople to survey the countryside and bring in all of the movable equipment that could possibly tow an airplane, and they pulled us up and put us on wooden planks at one end of the field, and we revved the engines up. By then it was dark, and all of the townspeople lined the field on both sides with their headlights. And here we're sitting at the end of the field, and we revved the engines up to full power and suddenly released the brakes and jumped off of it, hopefully that we would continue to move it because we had enough speed. And we took off through the trees at the end of the runway. We landed with tree branches in the landing gear. Eric was not court-martialed for that. We never heard any word. He never apologized to the crew. We didn't get off the ground till after midnight. And we didn't land till 3 o'clock in the morning back in Kearney, Nebraska. Oh my God. And that was the kind of guy he was.
Ooh, okay. So Kevin, you were talking about Di being one of the more interesting characters in the book. Could you expand on that?
Only in that, you know, if one of our missions was to really make these guys human and three-dimensional and not archetypes, you know, I think we did that with this crew and the way that, you know, Lucky's pathway to Thorpe Abbotts with these guys, I think illuminates, you know, there's a real humanity. It's an ugly side of humanity, but it brings sort of a storyline that we're not used to seeing in these kind of books. And I think it also, if you see the way, you know, Lucky, as he goes through his 25 missions, you know, Dice Crew is the first one to get through, which was also featured in Masters of the Air. And the fact that you know, it leads him to being, you know, the command pilot in Bremen, and the heroic actions he does over Bremen to save, you know, the low squadron. I like the Lucky's. There's a symmetry to the way Lucky's story, his World War II service, that works in a way that if you made it up, people wouldn't believe it. You know, with that and with Sully. I mean, Sully is another great example, and I think that's he's a really important piece of this story.
Well, let's get to some of those. Great segue. So, let's get to Thorpe Abbotts. You land there. You're finally there. You're in theater. What are your first impressions of the airbase and the men around you and what's going on?
Well, we get there and we don't even get a chance to fly a practice mission before we're suddenly thrown into combat against the Germans. And because we were so totally unfamiliar with what we were going to be confronted with, we were horrified that we were having to go out, fly through that soupy English weather to get up on top and form up in formation. And then we were supposed to have fighter escort, but there were no fighters in the theater that could accompany us beyond the enemy coast. And that was the Spitfires from the RAF. They were escorting us only as far as the enemy coast. All of Europe was occupied by the Nazis, and they had to turn around and go back and refuel. So we were flying naked with no escort, and unbeknownst to us, trying to prove this strategy of going out in the daytime at how high altitude was the best way to utilize our bomber force. But we were just innocent. We were so darn young, Tony. We were 21 years old, hairy-headed college kids, and we didn't know any better. We were, of course, in the military, you're ordered to not do or die, but not question why. And to get your butt in that airplane and go out and do what your job is supposed to be for the day. And I get asked frequently, well, you come back all shot up and barely make it home, and how in the world do you psych yourself up to get back in the airplane the next day? And I have to say, I don't really know.
You know, one of the things that I've heard other B-17 pilots talk about is the sheer fear and that you have flying in formation. You know, from the moment of takeoff, where planes are spiraling up and gathering up with fully loaded, you know, contingents of bombs, payloads of bombs. And then, of course, there's the weather that's involved that adds another layer of complexity and terror to it. What were some of the more memorable or frightening moments that you had flying in formation?
Well, actually, it isn't generally known, but when the bomber force turns on the IP or on the bomb run, you turn the airplane over to the bombardier. He interconnects it with his bomb sight through the autopilot, and he's literally flying the airplane, but you're still in formation.
Ooh.
So you've got to be constantly on guard to grab the controls and disengage the autopilot if the plane starts to drift too close to somebody else in the formation. That's just one of the things we had to contend with. Now, you mentioned also climbing through this horrible English weather. Sometimes on takeoff, the clouds were right down on the deck. And the only way that we could take off was to have the co-pilot keep the airplane straight on the runway and the pilot start out on instruments. Because if he starts out visually and gets airborne and then tries to transition to instruments, he can be upside down and he thinks he's right side up.
Yeah.
You get vertigo instantly. But the horrible thing about that is that there are 39 groups of heavy bombers in England. They're all taking off at the same time, flying through that same soup. And so the chances of mid-air collisions, which we had, is imminent, and that's in the back of your mind. And I remember we took off one day, and I was flying, and I heard this whoosh. And I thought, oh, my God, that was another airplane.
Oh.
It came that close, I could actually hear its engines and get the prop wash from it flying over my head.
My God. So not only did you have a number of accidents that occurred with just formation flying, but then you had to deal with the flak and the fighters. So let's take the fighters first, because in full disclosure, Lucky, you know, Ryan and I have interviewed a number of B-17 and B-24 pilots, but I think you're the first one we've ever interviewed who flew in the early days of the war. Like, you came there with the 101st, with 100th Bomb Group before fighter protection, before we had the numbers. I think every single B-17 crew member we interviewed has said this. Ryan, correct me if I'm wrong. They said, we didn't have it nearly as bad as the guys that came in before us. Well, you were those guys. Yeah. You were the ones he was talking about. Could you talk about what you remember from any of your missions, whether it was Bremen or Munster, about the fighters and the effect that they had on the formation?
Well, the first thing that we discovered was the ingenious ability of the Luftwaffe to perfect techniques to attack our formation. And one of the most effective was to get out about 3 miles in front of the entire formation in line abreast of 30 or 40 FW-190s and 109s, ME-109s and ME-110s. In line abreast and fly directly through our formation.
My God.
Now, that rate of closure between the two forces would be almost at altitude, almost 500 miles an hour. And we didn't realize it at first, but eventually we recognized that there was only a 4-second interval in that passage when their guns would bear on us and our guns would bear on them. The rest of the time, they were overshooting or undershooting, or they were just flying through us. You know, chicken. That was just like playing chicken. And we didn't veer, and they didn't veer. They had machine guns. They had 20-millimeter cannons, and they had rockets. And they would be firing all of those, and you just see their wings light up like Christmas trees. But you'd see that out of the corner of your eye because you were concentrating on flying formation. But you couldn't take any evasive action, or you couldn't do anything but just sit there and hope that they didn't ram you.
What effect would the rockets and the cannons have on a bomber formation?
Well, they really had a devastating effect on us. And so much so that what happened was that the upper turret could only come down to parallel to the flight path, and the ball turret could only come up to the same point. But it left that void, that window, that slot in between. And that's what they hope to get in and be able to come through our formation with. Of course, we appealed immediately to Boeing to give us some forward aimed guns. And that's eventually resulted in the Model G airplane. We went over with the Fs, and they mounted a turret underneath the bombardier's position in the nose, which the bombardier could with twin 50 calibers. And that pretty effectively interfered. It didn't make them quit, but it certainly gave them due cause to ponder the effectiveness of that technique. And so what they did was they reversed, and instead of coming through us head on, they'd get out behind us just out of gun range and lob these rockets and 20 millimeter cannon shells into the tails of our airplanes.
Well, let's segue to that, because another one of your grievances in the book is they made you be a tail gunner. Could you tell our audience what in the heck that was about?
Well, that's another thing that I'm very anxious to see how they treat in the documentary. We adopted a standing operating procedure that when your crew led the formation, the co-pilot was replaced by a command pilot to command the entire formation. The co-pilot then was designated to go back and fly the tail gun position, jeez, ostensibly as a fire control officer for the entire formation to the rear. Well, I'd never fired a 50 caliber in my life.
Oh.
And our crew led the formation, and I was bumped to the tail. And I got back there, and I said, what am I doing? What am I supposed to do? Well, the gunners loaded the guns for me and showed me how to aim it and that sort of thing. And he said, just aim and shoot.
It's that easy, isn't it?
Aerial gunnery involves a lot more than just aiming and
shooting. It does.
And what I didn't know was that on 50 caliber machine guns, you're only supposed to fire in short 3-second bursts, or else the heat from the bullets going through the barrel will burn out the barrel. Well, of course, we get under attack, and here are the airplanes coming in, and I just bear down on the triggers and burn out both barrels instantly. And the rest of the mission, I have to sit there like a knot on a log, and report those planes going down and what's happening back there to the pilot and the command pilot. But I said, I'm not doing that again.
Yeah.
When we landed, I refused to do that again. And they said, well, then you'll have to sit on the ground when your crew leads. So that's why I didn't finish up with that crew. I had four missions yet to fly.
I have to tell you, I agree with you. To me, it makes more sense to have the tail gunner stay where he is and to have the co-pilot miss his mission or do something else. I mean, I couldn't believe it when I read that in the book. And I really, this is another one of these things in the books where you had a grievance, and instead of just covering up, you're like, no, I'm addressing this. I didn't agree with it. And it made the book real. It made the book like, yeah, human beings fought this war. And, you know, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, was Dye's crew, which you're on, was the name of the plane, what was the name of the plane again that he flew?
Sunny.
Sunny. Was that the first one from the 100th to finish 25 missions?
Not the first plane, but it was the first crew.
So we get a lot of the Memphis Belle, but you served on the crew that finished 25 missions, the first one then.
That's right. And he was, I think, trying to make amends for his goof up at Newfoundland on the way over, to finish up as rapidly as he could and get the heck out of the group and go back home to his family. He was married, and the plane was named for his son, Sunny.
Yeah.
And that airplane, when we had flown about 18 missions in it, was being flown one day by another crew, and they got shot down. So we lost that plane, and we thereupon got another plane, and we named that Sunny 2. Hmm. And that's what they finished up in. But one other gunner and myself were the only two members of the crew that didn't complete the fastest tour in the European theater, and that was 89 days.
But that's an incredible piece of history I didn't appreciate. I thought all these years that the Memphis Belle and their crew was the first one, but it was the one you flew on. Now, of course, you wouldn't be able to leave with them because you were grounded for, you know, not being a tail gunner and your injury and all that. But well, a statistic.
Let me be clear, Tony. Yep. The Memphis Belle finished up in 1942.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. This is 100th bomber.
So it predated our Dyes crew. And actually, the Memphis Belle was not the first crew to finish. The first crew to finish was Hell's Angels. And they were being sent back to the States by for a bomb tour. And a brigadier general was being reassigned to the Pentagon. So he said, well, I'm going to fly this crew back because it's going to be a famous crew. And so he pulled rank, and he was flying it and flew into a mountain in Iceland. Killed them all.
You're telling me that the first crew to finish 25 missions had a replacement, a brigadier general, go on a glory ride and then killed them by hitting a mountain?
Absolutely.
Oh, my gosh.
And, of course, that was such an embarrassment to the Air Force that they had to designate another crew. And the Memphis Belle was the second crew to finish. But they're the ones who did return to the States and made the bomb tour. And they were lauded as being the first crew to make 25 missions.
I did not know that.
That is amazing. And this 25 mission mark, according to what's written in the book and other sources, this is pretty well established. In 1943, when you were flying, they say that people had less than a 25% chance of making it to 25 missions. I mean, when you're flying with these men and you're seeing the casualties, how soon did you realize that making the 25 mission mark was going to be really difficult, maybe impossible?
Very damn soon.
Soon, okay.
It was perfectly obvious that with the losses we were sustaining, and I will tell you that out in the 100th Bomb Group, out of the original crews, only 14% survived.
Unbelievable.
Out of the 40 co-pilots that went to the group, 4 finished a tour.
My God.
I was one of the 4.
Well, I mean, so
as far as your odds are concerned and your mortality, you couldn't even think about it. You couldn't allow yourself the luxury of wallowing in self-pity and saying, oh, poor me, poor me. I've got a death sentence on my shoulders. You just had to concentrate on what you were doing and get the job done.
And yet you had a bit of a crisis in the book. You had so you're from Tennessee, and a childhood friend of yours, Sullivan, you refer to him as Sully, when the Pearl Harbor was attacked, his mom signed off and off he went to war. He flew for the Canadian Air Force. And so he would be in the air war for a year or so before you join him. He would end up dying over there. And one of the things that is written in the book that I thought was amazing was you said there was a big difference between coming back from a mission and seeing the empty bunks, there's a difference between that and actually going to someone's funeral and seeing them buried in the ground. Could you talk about how that affected your outlook at that point?
Well, it was a game changer for me, a life changer, because he was not only a dear friend, but I did have to attend his funeral. I actually had to notify his mother at the bequest of his wing commander that he had perished on takeoff the day before I got there to visit him. And I've been back since, of course, to identify his grave site. And he is still buried in England. He's not in, wasn't repatriated to the States, although she had insisted that I arrange to have that done. And I said, well, he wasn't flying for the Americans. He was flying for the British. And I don't have any control over that. The contrast, Tony, you're exactly right, was that in an air war, there are no funerals, there are no memorials, there's no reference to the crew that went down. They're just gone. They're just immediately and instantly removed from the picture. And all you've got is empty bunks. But you don't have time to grieve. You've got to go out the next day and keep doing what you're doing and hope for the best.
So Lucky, that brings up a question that I've always wondered. You know, you think 25 missions, well, gosh, I'll just go over to England and in a month I'll be back. You know, 25 missions, one a day. How long did it take to get 25 missions in? And were you flying roughly every other day? I mean, how long would it take to do this?
Ryan, we were flying every day we could. And I had volunteered our crew for every mission. And we flew every mission out of the first 30 missions that the 100th Bomb Group flew. We flew 23.
Wow.
And the only time we didn't fly was when our airplane wasn't flyable or one of the crew was sick or something of that sort, or the weather. The weather did dictate in some instances whether or not the mission would be recalled or scrubbed. But we were flying as much as we possibly could. And that's why he finished so quickly. Now, he finished in 89 days, and that was the fastest that was ever done. But I still had 4 missions to fly when they finished up. And it took me longer to fly those 4 than it did the first 21.
Because you arrived over there on June 25th, and I think your last mission wasn't until February. And there was a lot of drama in between, and I'm not going to, I don't want you to cover all of that. I want people to read the book. I want them to, there's a lot of stuff. So for our audience, if you think we're covering everything exhaustively, we're not. These are some of the highlights.
And that's true. We're only covering select portions of the book of Damn Lucky. So don't feel like this podcast is going to, you know, encompass everything that Lucky shared with Kevin Maurer. You're going to want to buy the book and listen to it if you have an interest in these things. So this ends the second episode. In the next episode, you're going to hear Lucky talk about being able to finally fly his 25th mission and a whole bunch of other things. And for those who may not know, that 25th mission was a big deal. This is taken from the Bloody 100th Bomb Group's website, and it reads that 77% of the original 100th Bomb Group became casualties of the war. All but a very few of these occurred in less than the first 4 months of combat time. So think about that. 77% of the men that he traveled overseas with were either killed, captured, or wounded. Until next week. Okay, so what I thought I'd do for this post-roll is to go through some of the comments we get on YouTube. And I'll remind people again, YouTube is nothing more at this juncture than just a placeholder for the uncut, unedited, full-length videos that we pull the clips from. So we're not hiding anything. You can go there or the website anytime you want and listen to the whole thing, not just the pieces that we pulled out. I'm just going to click through a few of these. So right now, the George Menkoff series is being featured. George Menkoff loaded ordnance on B-17s during World War II. At the time when, you know, the whole Masters of the Air series occurred, meaning, you know, the same time frame. And for what a lot of people may not know is if you were part of a bomber crew, you could fly 25 missions early in a war. And then towards the end of the war is more like 35 missions and then go home. But if you were on the crew, if you were on the ordnance, you were a mechanic, if you were loading bombs, you didn't go home until the war was over. And George Menkoff was one of those. And Jim Harris wrote, kudos on the George Menkoff podcast. Another one from Wish Lemons. He was in the U.S. Navy. He fought on the heavy cruiser USS San Francisco. And John Shank wrote in. He said, my dad served on the Frisco during World War II as a quartermaster. He came aboard after her major battle repairs. I wonder if he crossed paths with Wish. Truly the great generation. Yeah, and for those who haven't heard the Wish Lemon series, please do. He was someone who, through a snafu, reported to boot camp and was immediately put on the USS San Francisco and thrown into battle. There was no training, no basic training. He didn't have a uniform. They didn't know what to do with him. And it took him about a year and a half to figure out, you know, when the war, we finally were able to catch up enough to send some of these guys to other places where he was needed. So at any rate, if you get a chance, you may want to check that out. Let's see here. We got some subscriptions. Here's one from Harold Dunn's comment, B-17 pilot and a POW. And Vino writes that soul calm and matter of fact, did his duty honorably and seems like nothing would rattle him. A steady, solid dude from that unique generation. Our country will sorely miss these guys and will never be the same. Our glory days are over as is this generation leaves us, and we didn't keep the lessons they left. Well, that's what we're trying to do on this podcast, and we're not alone. There's a lot of other people that are trying to let others know that, you know, history is something that is far more important for our schools, for our curriculum, for people to study than maybe was given credit for in the past. We firmly believe that that physics doesn't change in this universe. 2 + 2 = 4. But the thing that allows humans to understand their place in this world is their country's narrative, quite frankly. And that comes from history. Brody Henderson wrote on the video that we posted. It's not just on YouTube. It's also on our website. Basically, it's what we did is Ryan and I, mostly Ryan, I give him credit for doing this, was able to determine the most likely path that Bill Parker, who landed on the first wave on D-Day during World War II on Omaha Beach, would have taken up the bluffs. And then we were with Bill 2 years ago. He has passed away since then, on the 78th anniversary of his landing on D-Day. And Ryan and I took a video of us walking what we believe is probably the very similar, very, very close to the path that he took. And you can see what it looks like today. And what Brody wrote was, this whole operation, just imagining all the ships, all the anti-backup things along the beach, the tanks and sorts, still amazes me. Crisp salute to Mr. Parker and all the veterans. We have more to read here. I'll read one more. This is from the series we did on Captain Maydill. I'm sorry, it's from Bill Parker's series, but we talk about Captain Maydill, who Bill had a chance to visit his captain's grave. Captain Maydill died on the first day on D-Day, and Bill apparently was close to him, and we had a chance to find his monument, and Bill had some words about that, and you can see those on our website and YouTube as well. And what Kyle wrote was, what a special moment. I'm going to brag and say that this did not make me cry. It was close, though. Thank you to the best podcast out there. And thank you, Mr. Bill. Rest in peace, good sir. Your sacrifice will not be forgotten. Amen. So that's all I got for this week. We just want to share some of the comments we get with our listeners to know that we're reading them, we care, and they keep us going. So until next week.